Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching, a television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Richard Lawson.
I'm Chris Murphy.
And I'm Hilary Busis. And everybody, okay, calm down. Today we are talking Bravo and our favorite moments.
Mention it all, because you know what?
Bitch,
I f***ing earned my own living.
I made money. You didn't have any money.
So before we really dig into our favorite Bravo moments and get some listener calls and emails, let's just do a quick cursory history of Bravo. So as the good book says, on the eighth day, God created Bravo. And by that, I mean December 8th, 1980.
Wow.
But that version of Bravo is significantly different. The network mostly showed independent films and like live tapings of the performing arts.
Welcome to Bravo's Panorama series. I'm E.G. Marshall.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of opera.
A lot of opera. After a few ownership changes, the network became the property of NBC. In 2003, it launched its first big breakthrough program, which was Queer Eye for the Straight Guy.
He's sort of a t-shirt and jeans kind of guy.
He's going for a mountain man look, which means wants to be a freak show.
The executive behind that hit, a little fellow named Andy Cohen.
What a pregnant pause.
Yeah, yeah. The executive behind that hit, it was, I don't know, Les Moonves. No, it was not. It was Andy Cohen, of course. He started his tenure at Bravo in 2004 and was, whether you like him or not, responsible for a slate of reality TV juggernauts like Project Runway, Top Chef, and, of course, the Real Housewives franchises.
It may look like I have it all, but I want more.
In Beverly Hills, it's who you know, and I know everyone.
And then the Bravoverse exploded, and soon the Bravo-lebrity was created. It's the level of sub-celebrity that some people have never heard of, while others in the know have incredibly strong opinions about. And Andy Cohen is the master of that universe.
If all you've thought about since March is Vanderpump Rules, we say Bravo. If you dream of taking orders from the stud of the sea, or if you shout, how many sandwiches have you made for me? If you've been a fan since that first family van, Bravo!
So we all have different relationships to the behemoth that is Bravo. I mean, I think we got to go to the source. Richard, what is your Bravo history? It feels like Bravo played not a small part in your life,
how you
career.
Got to be where you are today.
Oh, it's fully the truth that if not for Bravo, I would not be sitting here right now. I would not have the career that I have, and thus the life that I have, were it not for The Real Housewives. I mean, I can also credit Gossip Girl, which is not Bravo, but it's like a Bravo ally.
I think that it's safe to say Gossip Girl kind of inspired things that would later be on Bravo.
That is certainly true. Two shows, that network and that show were, I think, in heavy dialogue. But yes, I recapped The Real Housewives, many of the franchises for Gawker. At this point, starting 15, 16 years ago, which is kind of crazy. Wow. I was right there when New York started, which is wild. And, you know, I met Bethany Frankel, I had meetings with
And you survived.
I survived. They wanted me at one point to maybe ghostwrite one of her books.
Oh, wow.
But I, yeah. And so I owe it a lot. And I think that what happened was that I burnt myself out on it because it was so much work and I was watching, you know, so much Housewives all the time and then writing these ridiculously long recaps that I stopped watching Bravo except for the competition shows for many years. And then when I met my boyfriend, who is a Housewives person, he got me back into it. And I was like, what have I been missing all these
years? Thank God for that.
So I'm back on the Bravo train in more ways than just the competition shows. What about you, Hillary?
Well, I actually have a similar story to you, which is that I, too, recapped Bravo shows in the early days, back when TV recaps were a great way to get your writing scene in the early teens, I should say. The recapping game just really exploded, and there was such an audience for granular descriptions of kind of anything. And I really recapped a lot of different stuff.
People's attention spans really we really wild. Used to have them.
But the recaps were great because you could just stick to plot points. You could be funny. You could be ridiculous. I would go into absurd things, and like so I just it makes sense that a lot of writers of our rough generation. Did get their stuff.
Yeah, it was a great way to be creative if you wanted to. It was also a really great way to become a critic because you could get it. It was an opportunity to look really granularly at one thing every week over and over and to like discern the difference between like things that are working and things that aren't. And yeah, just to try new things out. So as like a young writer writing TV recaps was a really great way to, you know, kind of dip your foot into the pool of the, like, wider culture writing sphere. Though that's a terrible mixed metaphor. I'm glad that I'm a professional at this. But in any case, one of my earliest recapping assignments was for the, I don't know if either of you would even remember this show, it was a Bravo competition show called Work of Art.
Oh, of course, yeah.
That's not ringing
Does
bells
ring,
for me.
Okay,
Jerry Saltz was a good judge.
He was
right?
He was one of the judges. Yeah, and he also wrote recaps at the same time as me. And I was like, shit, no one's gonna read this.
A judge is writing recaps.
Yeah, I know.
Conflict of interest.
Did you like recapping reality more than scripted?
You know, I don't know. I think it was kind of show by show. Honestly, if a show was good, then it didn't really matter. Right. I think that maybe reality fans are meaner than scripted TV fans.
Yeah,
and so you can probably be meaner in a reality recap.
And, you know, cynically, you're not maybe insulting someone who you might want to, like, buy your TV scripts.
Yeah,
that's also true. I mean, plenty of recappers went on to become actual TV writers.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know if that, if, you know, more
An
of them.
Oscar nominee a couple years ago, Pamela Ribbon, who had a short film. She was a big recapper. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, totally. So Work of Art was, it aired for only one season in 2010. It turns out that creating actual fine art in the same way as creating clothes for Project Runway or food for Top Chef is not very easy. You can't throw somebody in a room for 12 hours and they come out with something that's like museum worthy. But there was a period in like after the success of Project Runway and Top Chef, Bravo just tried a whole bunch of different competitions that were basically all the same format. There was one for hairdressers.
Mm-hmm.
There was one called Top Design for interior designers. There was this Work of Art, and like all of them were terrible. And I watched every single one of them.
Okay, so real competition show.
So yeah, I lean more toward the competition side. I still watch Top Chef every year, and now that it's been on for like 20 years or whatever, that's kind of wild to think about.
Yeah.
But and was a big Project Runway person back in the day. It is jarring to go back now and be like, oh, the Weinstein Company.
Yeah. Oh.
There's a lot of things that stick out to you now.
Time capsule. Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah. So I am not as much of a Housewives person, Chris. You cannot say that about yourself.
I cannot say that about myself. It's funny because I think we all have similar but slightly diverging paths because I definitely remember I was a Housewives person from day one. I remember, you know.
Were you like an actual child when they started?
No, I was an actual child to the point where the Daily Beast, me and my sister were interviewed by the Daily Beast for an article in 2011 called Why Teens Love It, Real Housewives.
Because they're gay.
It was a short article.
Yeah. Short article. Because I have no idea how they found us. I guess I had tweeted at Camille Grammer, and then she'd responded, and I had a little, my first touch of virality. But yeah, we just, it was something I guess me and my sister, we loved to watch, and I ate up all the recaps. I remember I would read like recaps, like your Gawker, like, and comments and recaps. So
it's
kind
of funny. You obviously also read my work of course, art recaps on the Wall Street Journal's culture blog.
Those are actually framed in my bedroom, lining the walls.
It's a gallery wall, fittingly.
A gallery wall. And then professionally, really my sort of start, I was, a night blogger at Vulture, and then they were like, oh, you have a lot of thoughts about The Real Housewives. And then I started recapping, this is, you know, in the pandemic, Real Housewives of Potomac and Real Housewives of Atlanta. And so I also did the recap game for a while, which was really fun and a really great way, as Hillary said, to like train a critical eye and develop a voice, because you could sort of do whatever you wanted. And the guardrails were really wide. And I do think that's part of the reason why I'm sitting here now, is because that was a really great avenue and a path for me to write about, you know, culture. I will say, I do have to shout out one thing that I said. I'm going to quote myself from this Daily Beast article, because I will say, you know what? I stand by this. 17-year-old Chris Murphy of New Jersey feels similarly conflicted about The Real Housewives. Quote, "These shows portray everything people want to have and absolutely nothing that they want to become."
Whoa, that kind of sounds like your tagline.
Yeah, that might be that. Maybe that's my real.
Okay, but here's my question to you: is how are you holding out on us and not telling us that you appeared on an episode of The Real Housewives of New York, which I did not know until our producer Emily Elias found the clip of you.
That is so important. I was wondering whether or not all my dirty little secrets would be aired on this episode.
It's a television episode.
I guess it is a television episode, and it is in my bio.
You're holding hands with Brooks Marks.
Yeah, we're skipping down the street.
We actually have an audio clip from it that Emily found.
Oh my God, wait, are we going to play a clip right now?
I also work as an SAT and ACT tutor. My one true purpose is to help Jewish boys who grew up on the Upper West Side channel their love of rap music into an essay that will demand Dartmouth's acceptance.
Yes! Okay. All the comedians were good. They have a certain, you know, sense of humor.
Howls, peals of laughter.
Peals of laughter. And you know how many people were in that room? Green Room 42 at noon, two people. Sonia, Luann, and their handler. So that laughter, a lot of laughter from them. Yeah, it was like a fake audition to open for Luann's cabaret show as a comedian.
Why was it fake? Because she had an actual opener already?
I think she had an actual opener, and maybe I'm divulging too much, but I don't think any of us were really sort of going to pack up our bags and go on tour with Luann. But they were like, oh,
you'd be like Bob the Drag Queen with Madonna, except
and that's exactly
with
the
far
same.
Less pay and
and a far more talented individual.
Right.
It was definitely a claim to, and to not get cut out, again, you don't always make the final edit, but to get a laugh and make the final cut, we'll always love Sonia and Luann for that.
And we have a Bravo celebrity in the room with us. I will never get over this.
I was always on Original Roni. You can't take that away from me.
Okay, so we are going to now talk about some of our favorite early Bravo moments. I obviously would have picked that clip of Chris Murphy had
I known
before today that it was there. But instead, we'll start with you, Richard.
So mine is from Top Chef, the first season, episode 7, which is the first ever Restaurant Wars.
Wow.
That was a concept that has been with the show since the very beginning. And it's a famous one line. It's a very angry chef named Dave Martin yelling at another chef named Tiffany Faison, who was, I think, in hindsight, very unfairly cast as the villain. Mm. But anyway.
An angry woman was not treated fairly on television.
That never happens.
In an industry like, professional cooking. I know, it's shocking. But yes, anyway, Dave hurls a particular mangled insult at Tiffany.
When you talked, you talked. So let me talk. Bottom line.
I also didn't bash you.
You've been bashing me the last 24 hours. Don't touch that. Don't touch that. Don't touch that. It's like,
when did I ever say that? Tonight?
Every time. I'm not your bitch, bitch. You know?
So I'm not your bitch, bitch was, those were different meme times back in the early 2000s. But, you know, had that happened now, I think it would have been a thing. I'm not saying I endorse that moment on Dave's part, but I think it does pretty accurately or succinctly rather describe what early Top Chef is like. I think anyone who's watched recent seasons, especially like the last two with Padma Lakshmi, like in Portland, like the show has become a lot more glossy, classy.
It's more professional. Mm-hmm.
More professional. It's about, you know, you're learning the deep culture of the food of whatever state or city you're filming in. There's tension, of course, but it's not about people. It's not people fighting backstage like in reality shows of old. But Top Chef first premiered at a time when that was sort of de rigueur, and you kind of had to have these moments of conflict. You had to maybe feed contestants alcohol. Mm-hmm. And it's just funny to look back at like how long Bravo, you know, some Bravo shows have been on and how much the network has evolved in some ways and hasn't in others, that Top Chef, which is now so distinct from The Housewives, mm-hmm. back in the day did have these pretty ugly moments that people really relished.
Yeah, I mean, it was the season two or three where they bullied one of the contestants. They shaved his head like on camera during.
And I think it was an interesting thing that it helped in the sense that Bravo shows ever do anything for society at large. Like it did at least bring to a wide audience something that people who hung out around chefs in their own lives knew, which is that those can be really intense, oftentimes really mean men. Mm-hmm. And
the bear.
Years later we have the bear. I think that is probably still true, but I think there's at least more of an awareness, and I think the food industry has tried to get away from that kind of stereotype that was a stereotype for a reason. Anyway, it's been interesting that Tiffany has had to reconsider. She now pops up on a lot of Food Network things, and she does some backstage stuff or video for Top Chef this season. So
where's Dave now?
I'm not sure, actually. He was a friend of a friend for a number of years. Ooh. I think he might be personal chefing. But anyway, I just wanted to bring that up because it was a famous line that is funny, sort of out of context.
The line reading is, I don't remember the episode or the fight. But that, I mean, you got to give it to Dave for an incredible line reading.
Yeah, it does seem like maybe not the most spontaneous insult.
He like, had that in his back pocket.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He deployed it at the right time, and it became, it's a very memorable soundbite.
Yeah, and I believe he won the challenge that he's upset about, and then he placed third, and Tiffany placed second, mm-hmm. and a guy named Harold won, and he went on to create Perilla and like a bunch of other fancy popular restaurants in New York.
Yeah, it's funny. Of all the reality shows, I think Top Chefs are by and large the most successful.
Yeah.
Like not
they're
even
not like
the winners,
world
but
famous, but they do well.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about, not to go outside of the Bravo sphere, like America's Next Top Model, like that didn't really spawn any top models.
Are you saying that show wasn't an earnest search?
I mean, Yaya DaCosta might be the most famous.
100% as an actress, I would say, probably.
Yes,
but Top
there are not very many. Winnie Harlow was
Winnie Harlow, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Before she changed her name.
But I would definitely say Top Chef and early Project Runway did produce some actual real players in those industries.
Yeah, well, yeah, so
brings
speaking,
us to
yes,
Hillary's
thank you.
Moment.
Thank you very much. Yes, speaking of Project Runway, I'm going to use as my, or to call out for my favorite early Bravo moment, this sequence from season two that kind of is like in the back of my brain at all times. Santino Rice, who was one of the contestants that year, he didn't win. I think he got second place. But he was just such like a larger than life, like reality show character such that he then became a Drag Race, an original Drag Race judge, like based entirely not. He was a good designer. He was talented and he made it far on the show, but just based on his personality more than that. And he was just like such a perfect reality creature. And this Tim Gunn impression that he did on one of the episodes just kind of shows why he was so good on this show.
Andre? What happened to Andre?
What happened to Andre?
Andre.
How's Andre?
Andre. Tell us a little bit about how you were feeling on the runway. Andre. What are you doing after the show? Andre, come out wherever you are. Now, Andre, stop hiding. I know you're in here. Let me untie you.
It's so good that you can almost not even tell when it's Santino and when it's Tim Gunn.
He's really good at the voice.
He's amazing. I mean,
mostly on that one name.
Andre.
Andre.
Sorry, I don't have any comment. I was traveling back in my mind palace to Daniel Vosovic and how cute he was that season.
He's still designing.
Oh, yeah. He's still around. No, that's a perfect clip because I think it really encapsulates how kind of perfect Project Runway was, especially in that second season.
How well cast it was, how well made it was. Like,
how kind of unexpected, because it was doing some of the silly reality stuff, but these were also serious artisans who were making interesting things, and there was a result at the end of every episode, and it felt classy, but also kind of silly and fun.
And that's self-aware, too. It looks like, you know, Santino was, like, in on the joke of Tim Gunn.
Yeah, like, by season two, Tim Gunn has kind of become this personality in his own right.
Oh, totally.
You know, he was sort of plucked from mainstream obscurity, like, in the fashion world. Yeah. He was a known figure, or at least, you know, at Parsons, he was a known figure. But, yeah, then this, it turned this, like, very humble, like, teacher into a giant star,
like one of the like preeminent reality TV faces of that like micro generation. And Santino was so, I mean, that was reality TV gold. And he was also combative and, you know, kind of a character in his own right. I mean, he
has complained about the way he was edited.
Yes, but ultimately, I think in hindsight, I don't think anyone is looking back, or I personally am not looking back at Santino being like, oh, what a terrible guy, you know, what a character.
Maybe you shouldn't read his Twitter right now.
Oh, God, and that is...
I will tell you that I just did.
That is something that I have not done. Let the record show, I did not.
In the years since Bravo and since Drag Race, Santino has taken a hard right turn into anti-vax philosophy and super MAGA.
Okay, so scratch everything we just said.
But this is, I mean, it's also just nice to like listen back at this and remember a simpler time.
Did either of you watch the most recent season of Project Runway, which was an All Stars?
And
they brought people back from season 1, 2, 3. I mean, like it was like, I mean, and then some more recent seasons, and it was fun. But also, I was like, oh my God, I've been watching this show for so long. And how did I get so old? Because I started watching this, like, it was like the big new show my senior year of college. And like, watching this particular season was with, you know, friends in an apartment after we graduated, and just feeling like, this show is about creative young people, and we're creative young people.
In New York,
I was still in Boston, but I wanted to head to New York, and I think maybe the show was a big reason why, because I was going to find Daniel Bostwick,
and
we would get married.
And then he'd introduce me to the Housewives, and then...
But yeah, so even just hearing that clip, I'm like nostalgic for that time, not just the show, but sort of who I was then. So
okay, well, that's nice. Well, speaking of who you were then, we actually have a little bit of fan mail about you specifically, Richard. And we found this comment on Reddit, which is so great. So you're on Reddit, just so you know, in case you didn't know. Okay, so this is a comment from a Redditor, Wires and Waves. Okay. Ugh, I love Richard Lawson so much. I've followed him from site to site. I wish he would write a book about what the kids from NYC Prep are up to now.
Well, thank you, Wires and Waves. That's very nice of you. I did recap NYC Prep for Gawker, and then I left that job and started a new job. I mean, I eventually went back to Gawker because the new job wasn't great. But and I told my editors at the new job, I'm so sorry, I have to recap one episode of NYC Prep because it was the season finale, and I can't just stop the narrative.
No,
that was a fun show to recap at the time.
That's such an important thing to mention.
Big asterisk.
Santino Rice asterisk there.
I forget if we've mentioned this on this episode or not, but the reason we're talking about Bravo is because a bunch of the older shows, not all, but a lot of them, are on Peacock now, and NYC Prep, which had been, I think, pretty much unavailable anywhere, is now one of them. And so I, with Hillary's blessing, was like, oh, I'll go, traipsing back into down memory lane, and it'll be fun to revisit NYC Prep. And in fact, I was horrified because it's a bad show. And also, I'm, you know, however many years older than I was then, I was in my mid-20s. Now I'm not in my mid-20s. And I was like, oh, these are children, and they should not have been on this show in this way, or in any way, maybe. And I felt immediately guilty. I did write something on the site, if people want to read that, about that experience. But
so I read what you wrote on the site, and I was like, and I read everything that you write, and I love everything you write, but I was like, there's no way Richard's right about this. It was so fun at the time.
Uh-huh.
No, at the time, I was also a child, watching other children.
Which that would have been amazing.
It was amazing. I knew people who, I'm from the tri-state area, I knew people who sort of knew them, and went to, you know, so it was sort of like watching Gossip Girl come to life in a weird way. And I very much, without Hillary's blessing, I rewatched some NYC Prep, being like, did this thing that like my friends and I, we consumed and enjoyed and made fun of, but like felt warmly towards, was it bad? And it actually is really bad.
Is it also just like that it's like cheapened, or is it mostly that
so
they're too young?
Because they're kids, they're not, because as I wrote in this piece, is that like, rich teenagers on TV was not new. There was there had been Laguna Beach. There was the Rich OC. Girls.
Basically, all of these shows exist because of the OC.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, so the OC was the fictional version.
The OC launches in 2003. Yeah. Then we get The Hills in 2006.
Laguna Beach before that, which was
Laguna Beach before that.
Rich Girls with Tommy Hilfiger's daughter on MTV, and so we were used to that. But the problem was that was MTV. And when you put teenagers on Bravo and basically treat them like housewives,
adults. Yes, you're
they have
them like
to
adults.
Go to little dinners and little parties. And you're like, you're 16. You're not going to any of this shit in real life. So they're pretending and they're bad at it.
And they're bad at pretending. And I will say the thing that struck me, too, in a way that I don't think I was thinking about when I was, you know, 15 watching this NYC Prep, is that the emphasis on, like, we're rich and class and whatnot coming from the mouths of babes is so off-putting. It's grosser to hear these kids talk about how much they care about status and money and looking down on a girl because she goes to one of the best public schools in the country. It just, that element felt a lot grosser in a way that might have been true to their experience or their families and their lives, but was much harder to watch now with, in hindsight.
Yeah, I appreciate that people have good memories of that show and the recaps. Don't revisit it.
Yeah, don't rewatch.
That said, Wires and Waves, that is actually kind of a good book idea.
It is really good. Well, there's some.
It wouldn't be about NYC Prep specifically, but like maybe one particular character from a show like that, that actually, I'm actually seriously like, I'm going to try, I might try to write something along those lines, actually.
Okay, well, wow, inspiration. Let's see if our next viewer chiming in gives us some more inspiration. We have a voice message from Susie Knightwell in England.
Hi, still watching. I didn't get hooked on Vanderpump Rules until the Scandival season, which means that I'm now watching season 11, and I've also gone back in time and I'm watching season 4 alongside. And it's kind of mind-blowing to see the progression and, you know, how the characters have changed, the relationships have changed, and how the whole vibe of the show has shifted. So my question to you is, which seasons of any Bravo franchise should be watched in parallel? I'm thinking, like, the best makeups and subsequent breakups, best friends to worst enemy relationships. What would you recommend?
I mean, that's a great question.
That is a really good question.
I have one suggestion, though. It's a sad one.
Okay, we might have the same suggestion, but
I think it's the first season of Real Housewives of Beverly Hills that essentially documents the sister breakup of Kyle and Kim Richards.
Yeah, it's a really good one.
I mean, Kim was going through a lot, so I don't want to say, oh, it's salacious fun, but there is an episode toward the end of that season where some backstory that had never been mentioned before gets screamed at somebody in a limousine. And I was like, what? And so if you're, you know, if our caller, Susie, is like into something dark, that is pretty fascinating.
Yeah. And it, I mean, and that will also get you all the way up to current day Real Houses of Beverly Hills, because Kyle sort of came to the forefront again in the most recent season. And now the third sister, Kathy, is now in the game too. So you're getting even more backstory in terms of Kim and Kyle. And then you'll see that parallel relationship of them sort of falling out. And then, boom, you throw in Kathy in the most recent couple of seasons and you see, okay, this sister dynamic is absolutely harrowing. Like, three sisters is caught dead in a ditch.
We have a lot to say about the Housewives, obviously, and I think that it's going to be time for us to dig into that now.
You are right indeed about that, Hillary. And so Still Watching, we'll be back in a moment. And when we return, it's time to really get into the Housewives.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then, I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.
Okay, it is time to talk about the Housewives. Chris, you're up next. You have your favorite vintage Bravo moment comes from an early Housewives season. But first, before we get into that, we have a message from another person named Hillary.
Wow.
Who has a story about Vanderpump Rules for us.
Is she the former Secretary of State?
No, Duff.
Oh, okay.
Of course.
So yes.
Hi, Hillary, Chris, and Richard. My name's also Hillary, and I am a insanely huge Bravo fan, so I'm really excited for any opportunity to talk about my favorite Bravo moments. My favorite vintage Bravo moment is definitely when Jack's got Stassi's name tattooed on his arm in season 2 when they weren't even together. I think we were just all extremely shook that this was his way of showing her that he was committed to her. And I think we were even more surprised by how impressed she was, right? Yeah. My personal connection to this story is that last year, me and my best friend, who's also a Bravo fanatic, really wanted matching best friend tattoos. So we decided to go the Jax Taylor route, and we got the same tattoo he did. So we both have Stassi's signature on our left inner bicep. Like crazy people. I also got a cameo from Jax last summer for my best friend, and I mentioned in my little write-up to him that we had these matching tattoos, and he freaked out in the cameo, and he included this little nugget that I'd like to share with you guys about when he got it covered up.
I covered mine up with a black rose, fitting, because, well, she's a black rose.
Which I thought was really funny, because he's not wrong. Anyway, thank you for letting me share my favorite Bravo moment. I'm full of them. Have a great day.
Wow. Oh my gosh. Thank you, Hillary.
Thank you, Hillary.
That is commitment. I don't know. We don't have enough time to get into Vanderpump, but Stassi and Jax are also such a great reality.
She's one of the
creatures
best
of reality. Yeah,
she's one of the best reality characters, yes, too, Princess Stassi. And so it's kind of an honor that you have her to commemorate her signature on your body. It's really kind of beautiful to me.
It is.
Kind of touched emotionally.
And of course, we would not have Vanderpump Rules if we did not have The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, which we would not have if we did not have all the other Housewives franchises. So, Chris.
Yeah. So, yeah, it all goes back, right? And so I picked a moment from Real Housewives. Real Housewives of Atlanta. It's been with us. It hasn't really ever gone away. It sort of launched a subgenre of Housewives. There are different archetypes of women who go on these shows. They're the business women, like Bethany Frankel and Ramona Singer, who are trying to, you know, make it big in business. And then you have the steadfast, like the no drama, real wives, like a Cynthia Bailey from Real Housewives of Atlanta and whatnot. And then you have my favorite subgenre, which we've actually sort of touched on today, maybe via Luann, the aspiring musical artist housewife who puts it all, who really believes in their talent and wants to share with the world. We have it on Real Housewives of Potomac, Ashley Darby, Candace Dillard Bassett, she's one, Luann de Lesseps in Roni. But the original, the real first person to ever do this on Housewives, I would say, it goes back to Kim Zolciak-Bierman, Real Housewives of Atlanta, season 2, her single, Tardy for the Party, written by Candy Burris, Real Housewives of Atlanta royalty. So I do think we need to pay our respects and listen to it and think about that phenomenon, because it's really important to me.
Hurry up, baby, don't be late.
Didn't get there on that one note.
That one note.
She nailed it in rehearsal, though.
Can you run that back? It's so good.
No, instead of more talking, we're just going to listen to that on loop.
Yeah.
So did they not have auto-tune in 2009?
That was auto-tune, oh, Richard.
No, that was, yeah, that was with a
and
lot
then the
of production
started
help.
Smoking, and they were like, this is the best we can do.
The lyrics are so funny, too. I'll meet you at the place.
At the place. Diamonds.
You know, there.
She meant the children's place, that old clothing store.
Oh, God. It's such a, and to, if you have the time to go to YouTube and watch the clip, you can see the other women reacting in real time to the performance, sort of trying to sort of bop along and look slightly horrified, but also kind of engaged into the performance that was happening right in front of them. It just, to have that amount of confidence and that amount of, I don't give a fuckness and pursue that. That's something, there's something commendable about it. And we also, you know, Erika Jayne has done it. Dorit.
Kim bravely opened the door.
Kim opened the door.
And I would say that some of the efforts post-Kim have been a little bit less embarrassing.
Oh.
I think Countess Luann, who cannot sing, has committed at least to what I think she thinks the bit is.
Yeah. No, yeah.
I do always wonder, and maybe you have more insight into this, Chris, than I do, but like, how seriously do any of them take it?
Well, some of them, so I think there's a range. I mentioned Candace from Real Houses of Potomac. She's actually a very good singer and has some good music and basically quit the show to pursue her music career full time.
Right.
And then you have others, you know, a Melissa Gorga from Real Housewives of New Jersey, who sort of know that this is another way to monetize and to make some money and get some fame from the platform that they have. And I do think Luann, by hook or by crook, who knows why, has fallen somewhere in the middle where there's somewhat of a joke to it, right? It's not, she's not Barbra Streisand, but she's now legitimately performing at music festivals, selling out cabaret venues across the country.
The entire joke is like, let's go laugh at this lady who is a bad singer. Like, that's not enough to sustain years of
it is not
cabaret
enough.
Act.
No. And she also has some bops. Chic C'est La Vie is a
c'est
bop.
Bon.
C'est bon, c'est bon.
I have seen Luann perform live at the Borgata in Atlantic City.
Perfect venue for her.
Yeah. And you know what? It was fun.
I bet.
She kind of got what I think doing cabaret is the good idea. Because like that can be a little bit jankier, and but you're going for the personality, not for the perfectly, you know, sung notes.
And the thing that I'll say about these women, which is maybe arguable, but I don't think it's true, a lot of them have something about them. There's something about these ladies that
something about her is the name of the sandwich shop
of Aria
spinoff.
I was recently at the premiere party for the documentary "The Idea of You" about Anne Hathaway and Nicholas Galitzine falling in love. Luann and her former Housewife co-star Dorinda Medley were there. And kind of playing it modest, like they were sort of standing near us because we weren't really paying attention to them. Some people were coming up and asking for selfies, but otherwise they were kind of just like at the party. And I couldn't stop looking at both of them. Luann is obviously so striking and like,
handsome,
but Dorinda
woman
too. And I was just like, oh, there's a reason they're TV stars. Like there is something there. It's not just that they are willing to do anything on camera. There's something else going
on. There is something else going. Yeah. There is something else special there. And I will say, you know, while we're talking about Housewives, let's stick with Atlanta and the Kim Zolciak of it all. And we actually have a voice memo from Mia in New York.
Hi, I'm Mia. My favorite vintage Bravo moment is from season 3 of The Real Housewives of Atlanta. I simply refer to it as Greg borrowed $10,000. In this iconic scene, Nene Leakes confronts friend of the show Dwight about a rumor that he spread around Atlanta that Greg Leakes, Nene's now deceased husband, owed him $10,000. This was also an introduction of Phaedra Parks, where we saw her interact with the rest of the Housewives cast in a public setting. And we also got Nene's iconic confessional, where she shared that she didn't see any fabulosity in Phaedra. It was honestly a shady good time that displayed the dynamics of the cast really well.
Oh, wow. That is, it's actually, it's sacrilegious that we've talked so long about the Housewives and we haven't mentioned Nene Leakes, who is
the true grand dame, with apologies.
To Karen Huger, apologies to Karen Huger, grand dame. She's the true grand dame. Someone who was so effortlessly funny and full of incredible bon mots and one-liners that she's still probably one of the most used meme formats to this day. Oh, yeah. I see her every day on Twitter.
It doesn't matter if you've seen the show.
She was on a Ryan Murphy comedy show.
Multiple
shows.
Glee.
And she was good.
She was good. And the other one with the gay guys.
New Normal, yeah.
Yeah, that one.
The Ryan Murphy show with the gay guys? Which one?
Yeah. You know, that one. The only one. But
People
that,
vs. OJ?
But NeNe and Dwight, that is such an incredible moment. And I also do think we should mention the Real Housewives and of Atlanta, but also a lot of these, they gave us really great side characters that were often ridiculous gay men who were very also hilarious and also had like a venue and a skill set and presented challenges to these women. I mean, Sheree's, who's going to check me, boo? That's another iconic Real Housewives of Atlanta moment of a head-to-head between Sheree and a party planner that you can't really have a housewife without, you know, her gay frenemy. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you really need that. And many of these shows have that, and that is such the $10,000.
Everything we were saying also just makes me want to go back and rewatch the 30 Rock episode Queen of Jordan, which is such a perfect
parody. Satire, perfect,
like clearly written by Tracy Wigfield, who knew her shit. Like every single trope of these shows she just like nailed to the to the T. That's the letter I couldn't think of.
The wine throwing.
My single is dropping.
Incredible. Somebody should do
incredible
that.
Incredible stuff.
But that was, oh my God. And Mia, thank you for highlighting that seminal moment. And also for introducing Phaedra into the conversation.
I never watched Atlanta, but I watched The Traitors. And she is so funny. She's so perfect on that
NeNe
show.
NeNe was wrong about one thing.
She has fabulous.
I think that if Dan hadn't screwed her over, she would have won.
Yeah.
Or at least come very close.
Yeah. She sort of had to give up by the end because she was playing a one-woman game. But if Dan hadn't kneecapped her.
Yeah.
Because she's just...
Well, and if Parvati hadn't been the most suspicious person in the world.
Suspicious-looking person.
Yeah. Well...
We're all doing impersonations.
Anyway, that's for another episode.
Maybe another season. Maybe we'll do Traitors someday. Staying on the Housewives track, we have an email from Nick Feldman. He writes, "It's hard to believe how much drama was captured in the first season of Real Housewives of New York with only 7 episodes. The seasons now are like 20-something,
20,
right?
Yeah, 22.
Ramona vs. Simon and Alex was the best, and Bravo needs to embrace more weirdness, eccentricity. Any scene with Avery eviscerating Ramona was the best scene."
That is, gosh.
Yes, I agree with that, Nick. I think that first season of New York now seems sort of quaint because no one was really aware of what to do on camera. They weren't trying to craft narratives for themselves. I mean, Alex and Simon were, but not in the way we talk about it when we talk about Housewives now.
Yeah.
Everyone was just being a complete freak.
And their true selves.
As Housewives scholars, would you guys say New York is where it really starts, like more so than the OC?
Well, I think the thing about I've always wondered about this because OC was first.
Mm-hmm.
But OC is, to my mind, about a bunch of space aliens. Like, that is such a, like, cloistered, weird world that they live in.
Yeah.
They're all a bunch of mean Republicans.
Gated community.
It just, like there's something missing there. And I think that New York felt a little bit more accessible, maybe because, I don't know, half the country lives, you know, toward the Eastern Seaboard.
Racists on that show.
Well,
at that point, sort of.
But I don't know. New York, I think, just, you know, kind of met the moment a little bit better. Orange County was, of course, created to be the real life Desperate Housewives, but people liked Desperate Housewives for different reasons than they liked Real Housewives. And I don't know.
Yeah.
But anyway, that first season is really like remarkable. And Ramona Singer, so they had one space alien.
Yeah.
This season. I forget if I've said on this podcast the time that I met her.
No, I don't know if you have.
So it was.
Say it again.
It was through Bethany. There was a party
friend,
for
Bethany.
One of her books at Japanese, which is a restaurant they used so many times on Bravo shows. The first time Sebastian meets Taylor is at Japanese
on
NYC Prep. There's a lot of Real Housewives. Anyway, so I went to Japanese, felt like I was already in the show because we were at Japanese. And was introduced to Simon and Alex, and Alex McCord told me, like, oh, we don't mind the recaps making fun of us. We consider this our own personal Waiting for Guffman. And I was like, well, that's actually a healthy outlook. But then at the end of the night, Bethany Frankel was like, is there anyone else you want to meet? And I was like, well, I didn't get to meet Ramona. Luann was not there. And she said, oh, okay, well, I will introduce you, but you just do it right before you leave. And I was like, okay, sure. So I finally got my coat and everything. I was like, okay, I'm ready. So Bethany brings over Ramona. Ramona's eyeing me, like, very warily. And Ramona whispers something in Bethany's ear. Bethany nods. She whispers something back at Ramona. Ramona nods, looks at me again, nods her head again, and then darts up to me, gives me a little hug and a cold kiss on the cheek, and then turns around and, I'm not kidding, runs away.
That, ew,
and
wow.
I will go to my grave never knowing what was said.
It's like the end of Lost in Translation.
Yeah. I just will never know. Yeah.
God, to be eyed by Ramona Singer, her eyes are a huge part of her personality too. So that, that is harrowing.
And at the time, I think that she was mostly viewed as a somewhat obnoxious eccentric. Yeah. Now her profile has evolved to be a Trumpian nightmare.
Yeah, gone, like, off the rails. Yeah.
So I don't have any affection for that Ramona, the current Ramona.
But the one who was scurrying away from you into the night.
Like some sort of lizard who had just, and I just turned the lights on.
Wow. Oh, God. Anyway,
that is a wonderful story. Thank you for that anecdote. We should, let's wrap up this segment with another email from Rachel, who runs a Bravo fan account called University of Bravo. She asks, what is your Housewives tagline? I'm not as much of a Housewives scholar as you guys. I do not have an answer ready. Chris, I feel like you've thought about this.
I thought about it a little bit. a little bit. And it's definitely changed over, generations, the eras of my life. But okay, so right now I write for Vanity Fair, if anybody knew. So you have to remember that. That's part of the tagline. Mm-hmm. Okay. Rub me the wrong way, and I'll write you out of my life.
Ooh.
Oh, that's good.
I like that.
Wrong, right?
Yeah.
I have spent some time. I did not just come up with that.
That's not spontaneous.
That's not spontaneous.
Yeah, I'm trying to come up with something that's like me turning and being like, from recapping to, and I just, what rhymes with that? I don't know. Heel tapping. I don't know. maybe my thing is I want to be a tap dancer.
I don't know what my storyline is, so I guess it's kind of hard to reverse. You got to reverse engineer it.
I think it would be fun if you turned and you were like, I don't know what this is.
What show are we on?
I'm doing this as a favor.
I thought this was Top Chef.
Yeah, I think I'm a friend of. I'm not a housewife.
And you come with a vape pen and you're a psychic and you say mean things.
You predict the future.
I'm not a main character. I'm popping in and I'm leaving. And everyone's like, oh, I want more of her. But, like, they don't.
No, yeah, I know they do. Enough. You stir the drama. You do. Yeah. That is amazing.
All right. Still watching. We'll be back in just a moment. When we return, we're looking at Bravo's relationship with the fourth wall.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
So you watch the early versions of any of these shows, not the competitions, but any of, you know, the straight reality unscripted shows. And I think that there is a decent amount of work done to make it seem as not as though we're like flies on the wall, but as though the things are happening on the show are happening because they're happening for real and not because a producer made them happen, not because there was some event that was invented so that, you know, you would get everybody in the cast in the same room. They don't want to look too produced, I guess. And I think that now those days are out the window. Like, we are very far past the time when, you know, the reality and reality TV could appear without, like, many layers of scare quotes around it.
Yeah, because they are essentially, I mean, it's interesting. There is an artifice to these shows, but sometimes reality clashes with it, mm-hmm. and you have to then kind of acknowledge the fact that, oh, something real has just happened to me, and I just cannot have a camera around me right now, or whatever. Or something is happening off camera, and you watch a producer scrambling, as happened in the Real Housewives of Salt Lake finale recently, where a huge bombshell was dropped, but the producers were kind of caught unaware, so you see a little bit of the production scramble.
And that, I think that's a good, a great example of where I think Bravo is, and at least, maybe not reality TV writ large, but at least The Housewives, where it's sort of this postmodern era where we all know what the game is. It's not 2008, 2009 where you can sign up and be like, I'm not really familiar with this show. I don't really know what these women do or what the fans' reaction to them. Everybody has some awareness that, you know, they're on a show and that there is a give and take between the audience and the public and the housewives. And sometimes now we're at a place where things have gotten really thorny. Some of these women have gone to jail. Some of the, you know, divorces have happened. Fights have happened. There have been legal battles. That all is happening in the public sphere, and we're all aware of that because of the information age. So to act like that's not happening on the show, it can't really hold. The center can't hold in that way anymore. So I think Real Housewives of Salt Lake City, this most recent finale, which was like groundbreaking because something that was really happening off camera with a woman who sort of infiltrated the show as a fan who had fake accounts, reality Von Tees, had a fake account dedicated to tearing these women down and then made her way onto the show. That was really kind of the first postmodern finale of a Housewives season. And I don't know if that's sustainable and can happen for every franchise, but it really showed how the real world can butt up against the production of the show in a really thrilling way.
And I think that it's interesting on the Girls Trip spin-off series where it's kind of like Housewife All-Stars, like from different franchises, go on a vacation together, things ensue. They are allowed to talk about production on that show. Like they can be like, well, Andy said that you're fired from this, or in a way that you're not. You know, like on the main flagship shows, like Denise Richards used to just say Bravo, 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 Bravo when they didn't want her to use things. Yeah. Like there are ways to manipulate your airtime without, like, but on the Girls Trips one, you can just, doesn't matter. You can talk whatever you want.
You can say, and you can also talk about what happened all those years ago. The things that we didn't know and what was happening, what the producers were telling you.
That just feels like a necessary step. Like, the viewing audience is so much more sophisticated now and knows so much more, not just about reality TV production, but about TV production than they ever did in the early days. I mean,
because it was relatively new back then. Yeah. I mean, it was, there was Survivor and American Idol in 2003, 2004, but it was all kind of new.
Yeah.
And I mean, Survivor is its own animal. But yeah, like American Idol, you're not like going home with the contestants. No. You're not spending time with them off the stage, really. You don't get a peek at what the production actually entails in that way.
You're seeing them in the pressure cooker of creating something or performing something. Yeah. But yeah, you're not sort of peering in on their private lives. And I think that we should mention, you know, that Bethany Frankel, who has been leading a charge, kind of against the labor practices of these shows
and against Andy Cohen,
against pay structures, against all this stuff. And I think that the more that sort of argument that you know, some of these women get famous, even fewer get rich, but like they all are making some money, whatever, you know, they benefit from it, but also they're giving a lot to the shows more and more. And that some of that is of their own choice.
Some of it is
not. Yeah. And I think that Bethany, you know, however you feel about her, is right to kind of address that stuff. And I think the more that becomes part of the conversation around these shows, I think the more that fourth wall has to get broken.
Right. Yeah.
Because you have to be like, if Bravo even wants to protect itself, they have to be like, well, no, here's a scene where a producer like comfort so-and-so or tell someone they don't have to do something, you know, because now, like, the end of the Hills, you know, the backdrop gets taken away. And it's like, and I don't, does that mean that that's the beginning of the end for this show, the Housewives? Maybe. But, like, you can't pretend anymore that this is happening in a vacuum.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, and I think it's to the show's credit to, I think that it's to the show's benefit not to do that. Yeah, not just because it kind of brings back a sense of authenticity, but also because I think that one of the reasons people like watching these shows is because the relationships are so Byzantine. There's so much history. Like, there's so many inside jokes. Like, you want to feel like you're inside of something, like you're a part of something, and like you understand something that not everybody does. And like, I think that you only get that feeling more if you're kind of brought into the production and seeing behind the scenes.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the word authenticity gets thrown around a lot, and especially on a show, a reality television, it feels like that's sort of out the window, and we know that it's a production, but it is honestly kind of more authentic to show how the bells and the whistles and the strings and pulling behind the scenes, given that we all know that it's there now in a way that we didn't understand, you know, a decade and a half ago.
I think the big reckoning that actually might have to happen and fundamentally alter the show is that fans have to kind of guiltily admit, myself included, that a lot of their favorite moments happen because of alcohol and maybe other substances, and that
and because of manipulation
You're under that microscope, you're nervous, you're going to drink a little bit more than you normally would, or you haven't eaten because you wanted to fit into that outfit or whatever,
and that's not good,
you know. And some of these people come into the show with substance abuse problems, and look, that can be covered on the show. I'm not saying no one should drink on the show or whatever, but like the way that it's sort of foisted on them as if they're on MTV's The Challenge.
Yeah.
The earlier seasons of that show. It's like that might have to actually change, because you can't have someone who is filming something for a nationally or internationally broadcast show and wake up the next morning and not remember what they filmed. Yeah. I mean, that feels...
That feels bad. You know, you can't have somebody who's in recovery and you're providing all of this alcohol for everybody else around them. Like, that is... It's not a safe work environment.
But I do think if that... Exactly. And it is a work environment, and that's what Bethany's been trying to drive
home. Yes, it should be treated
as a work environment.
And so, not like we're all having fun. Mm-hmm.
I also think that most of these housewives, at least your favorites, are plenty capable of saying crazy things and getting in fights.
Without any of that.
After one glass of wine, you know, let's allow... You know, because Love Island, the British show, they have a rule, 2 alcoholic drinks per night. That's it.
That's
and then they cut them off. And because they don't want it to be the sloppy drunkie show, which was more in vogue 10 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, after the Bachelor in Paradise scandal.
Yeah.
I mean, scandal seems like a, I don't know, kind of flippant word to use.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that everybody in production of reality TV is more aware now of like the dangers that are enabled by that practice.
Yeah. And so part of the fourth wall might in some senses be, you don't have to mention it explicitly, but like the knowledge that the audience has that like parameters have been set.
Yeah.
A scenario has been created. This is not like they didn't just wander into this restaurant or this party. This was
all
planned.
You don't have to go overboard.
Yeah, exactly.
No, but just a knowledge. Yeah.
Not just like, oh, I didn't think I would see you here.
Yeah.
Right, what are you doing here? Exactly. Yeah. So I think there's a future, I think, but they do have to acknowledge some of the bad practices.
Yeah.
And maybe new interesting things will arise from that thoughtfulness. I don't know. So that does it for this episode of Still Watching. We will be back on May 16th with our new show, Netflix's Bridgerton. If you have any thoughts or anything else about that show, you can always email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com.
Until then, you can find me at Hillabuster with 2 R's.
I'm at Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S.
And you can find me at Christress.
This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our producer is Emily Elias, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes. We were engineered and mixed by Jake Loomis. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. We'll be back on May 16th with Bridgerton. Looking forward to seeing you then.
I'm Richard Lawson.
I'm Chris Murphy.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast, a weekly television podcast that obsesses over all things TV.
Chris, Hilary, and I are at your service to recap and analyze the best that's out there and what you should be watching.
Plus, we're talking to the stars and showrunners about how exactly it all got made.
New episodes of Still Watching drop weekly wherever you listen to podcasts.